Hi, Ann Parsons. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ann Parsons teaches, she writes, she helps people understand their place in U.S. history. She teaches history and directs the public history program at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She writes her upcoming work, about to be published in October, is Asylum to Prisons, Deinstitutionalization and the Rise of Mass Incarceration After 1945. So, Ann Parsons, it's pretty widely known that the closing of most state mental hospitals through the late 20th century and the rise of mass incarceration, they happened at the same time, and that gave rise to the idea that this deinstitutionalization was a prime cause of mass incarceration. You've written that it's much more complicated, and give us the background and your assessment.
You really hit the nail on the head there when you say that the closure of hospitals and the rise of prisons were really happening at the same time, and a lot of times people blame deinstitutionalization for the rise of prisons. But what I've found in my research is that actually, as hospitals were closing, many of those people who were formerly at hospitals went to nursing homes or were returned to their communities, and many people actually were not then imprisoned. There was a group of people that ended up being picked up by the police and put them back in hospitals, put back in prisons, but that was not what happened largely. What I found generally was that deinstitutionalization was this moment when society was really rejecting the idea that we could confine people sheerly because of their psychiatric disorder. And as we were rejecting that notion, often called anti-institutionalism, the same time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, this fear-based law and order politics was rising up, and ultimately we really embraced a new type of institutionalism, that of prisons. So we were rejecting the asylum, and prisons really rose up. And ultimately, those prisons absorbed many of the functions of the former asylums.
Right. One little footnote that's interesting about your work. The old asylum was also, it functioned to suppress deviance. But in the 50s and 60s, deviance was being redefined. So the old asylums had a lot of people who, sexually active young women, were put in mental hospitals, especially amongst the rich. And also gays and lesbians were committed to mental hospitals, often by their families or by doctors, because gay and lesbian conduct was seen as terrible deviance and a sign of mental illness. That was my sense.
Yes, correct. Many young women who were sexually active were identified as sexually deviant and then placed into hospitals. But also, homosexuality, as it was called at the time, was not only seen as deviant, but it was also legally criminal in many ways. Sodomy was criminalized. So people who were deemed sex offenders could be arrested and actually placed in hospitals rather than prisons.
Let's talk about mass incarceration. That's when I interrupted. In your writing, you talk about the many reasons. I think we should, one of them, of course, is that some of the people were, you know, without money, without friends often, without any support, wound up on the streets, and the police didn't know what to do, and they went into jails, and they brought them to jail. Sometimes they are inebriated in one way or another, and they wound up just being processed as prisoners and put away for a while. But let's talk about the social reasons for the rise of the prison and the prison industry, social and political reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, since I focus on the intersection of the mental health and the prison system, I'll talk specifically about those and how they influenced it. One thing that deinstitutionalization did unexpectedly cause was a lot of fear-based language around the release of patients, even though many patients actually were not dangerous at all. What I was finding in the 1970s, 1980s, as I was going through papers in the Philadelphia archives, was fear of quote-unquote maniacs on the streets was at one point one of the big fears in Philadelphia. So it's in many ways unfounded, often focused on very high-profile cases, not many people. But deinstitutionalization was releasing a new tide of discrimination against people with psychiatric disorders in the 1970s and 80s. And so that was one of the things that was fueling that fear-based law and order politics of that period, fear of the streets. It really ends up being embodied by Goldwater in his presidential campaign, taken up by Lyndon B. Johnson, and then through Nixon and Reagan, these wars on crime. So really, deinstitutionalization did unexpectedly kind of fuel some of these law and order politics that often were more political than actually grounded in fact.
Mm-hmm. And even psychiatry, you know, the sort of the science of medicine decided that, I mean, a lot of the psychiatrists began defining schizophrenia and other mental disorders as leading to great paranoia and violence, which mm-hmm. in fact turns out to be not the case. So mm-hmm. a lot of people with problems were defined as criminally insane, even though they weren't likely to commit crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. This is also really where race comes into play, too. Race is a critical component of the rise of mass incarceration, as books like The New Jim Crow or the documentary 13th have shown. When it comes to mental health, there's a really great book called Protest Psychosis by Jonathan Metzl. It looks at how, as he calls it, schizophrenia became a black disease, how psychiatrists in the 1960s and 1970s increasingly focus the diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenic around African Americans, and African American men in particular were more likely to be diagnosed with it, and as a result be diagnosed as criminally mentally ill and placed in more secure, maximum security hospitals. And so you really see this concept of who is dangerous is incredibly inflected by racism in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s.
Which, in fact, still, it seems to me, is discuss that. I mean, there's just a huge amount of racism and fear based in these law and order politics and get tough on crime and protect your communities. And that's still going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons, one of the main arguments of my work is that as we're thinking about mental health and how to address our crisis of the fact that our largest mental health centers are behind bars and prisons and jails today, one of the main solutions has been, okay, let's fix our mental health system. But ultimately, it's impossible to just focus on fixing the mental health system. It's really important to look at how racism is playing out in our criminal legal system today, how it's affecting people who are African American with psychiatric disabilities, how they're being picked up by the police and put into prisons and jails. It really ultimately is important for us to be really working to reduce mass incarceration and thinking about racism in that system in order to try to address this issue of mental illness and our prison system today.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Ann Parson, who teaches history, and she also directs the public history program at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And her book is going to be coming out soon, Asylum to Prisons, Deinstitutionalization and the Rise of Mass Incarceration After 1945. We've been discussing mostly the rise of mass incarceration after deinstitutionalization, which only was one of the causes of rise in the prison population. Ann Parsons, let's switch gears some. The estimates are that between, 10 and 30% of the population at some of our lockouts and prisons are people with really serious sort of mental impairments of one kind or another. Now, that's a huge number of people, far more than the number of people who were ever in asylums, and especially since many of the people, as you talked about, were in asylums for homosexual conduct, same-sex activity of one kind or another, or sometimes they were just people with dementia and Alzheimer's and stuff if they live long enough. So we really are diagnosing, at least they're sort of diagnosing in prisons, of a tremendous number of people. And one reason, as you pointed out, was that now mental health problems are somehow criminalized. But Another hypothesis is that we're driving a lot more people. I sort of hesitate to use the phrase, but it's all right in this context. We're driving people crazy. We're creating a society where people decline into deep dysfunction. How do you see it in terms of, are there really more people being, is it just more people being diagnosed, or is it that, in fact, there's a lot of factors in the social life, particularly amongst the bottom 60 or 70% of people, where a lot of them, mm-hmm. In fact, are so stressed and that in one way or another, they retreat into something that's sort of similar to one of the mental health categories?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. And certainly I know it's one that's on a lot of people's minds today, as we've had a few recent suicides of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, of what is the state of mental health in our world today. You know, I've been reading a lot of reports about how the rate of suicide has increased by 30% since 1999. And it's incredibly distressing that as we've learned more about mental health and also as the mental health consumer movement has grown, in fact, suicide and many other mental health disorders have been exacerbated in our modern culture. It's really distressing. When it comes to prisons, I've done tutoring in a men's prison in Illinois, in central Illinois, and I talked with them about mental health and imprisonment, and one of the things that they really responded, and I think it's important to keep in mind in this conversation, they really responded that they felt that the prison population was also over-psychiatrized, that almost all of them were given an asocial diagnosis of some sort, and that it's important to kind of be cautious as we talk about statistics, because they felt that often there would be a lot of diagnosis of people in prison that was potentially not justified. The other thing that I really learned from them is, and also from many other prison activists, is that prisons can be themselves disabling in many ways, particularly the use of solitary confinement that actually exacerbates mental illness. I don't know your thoughts on these or what you've come across in your work, Bill.
Yeah, well, at least some of the stuff I've read sees, let's say, not only does prison exacerbate any sort of underlying fragility for people, but so does homelessness, so does having dead-end, low-wage jobs or loss of work, mm-hmm. or in the end of family support, or illness. It seems to me the society just has fewer resources for caring for people and supporting them. And in fact, income has gone down. So a lot of these men who might have started families and been stabilized by their wives and other families and their workmates in fairly stable jobs where they could earn a living, they can't any longer. It seems to me that mm-hmm. the life opportunities for a lot of the people out in the bottom 60%, and some are downwardly mobile from the upper middle class, they wind up sort of solitary on drugs or in sort of male groups that are really irresponsible and drug using. It seems to me that we've made a society where there's lots of people who are unable actually to find a dignified life. Mm-hmm. Even when they fight hard to do it, even when they're sort of smart but a little bit off, and they lose jobs or they can't ever get them, or they suffer a disabling injury so that they can't, and then they're just tossed on the garbage heap in society, mm-hmm. it seems to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the contribution of that is to this mass incarceration, but I suspect it's something.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're really onto something, that the lack of sustainable livelihoods and, you know, access, often education. I know I'm in North Carolina right now. It's a huge struggle over access to quality education, housing, transportation, jobs. It's really central. At the very same time, you know, the vision in the 1960s, when President Kennedy announced in 1963, I think just a few weeks before he was shot, and signed the Community Mental Health Centers Act. And the vision was really of reducing asylums and being able to have a society that was able to care for people with a variety of mental health disorders. And the vision was really to be able to support people in their communities. I think the lack of sustainable livelihoods really undercuts that vision. The other thing, and this is where mass incarceration came in, prisons are so expensive today that ultimately they were built up. The states across the country really poured billions of dollars into their prisons. And so for us today, one of the great possibilities of decarceration is reducing how much we're putting into prisons and instead helping to shift that into access to medical, mental health services, housing supports, employment. Although I do think you're right that it's about thinking about society as a whole, not just what the state can offer. But right now, the state often ends up putting its money into people at the point that they break the law rather than at the point of need.
Ann Parsons, really good talking to you. Maybe another time we can talk about what really could be done and should be done with the just by reprogramming some of the monies that are now being used to support prisons and the prison industry and the prison guard unions that have a lot of power in maintaining this whole apparatus. And there's, of course, the new Jim Crow as well. Anyway, thanks a lot. We're out of time.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate being here.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Take care. Monet and left foot.